One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Welcome, everybody, to Ruined. It's a podcast where we ruin a horror movie just for you. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Allison.
Allison, how you doing?
I'm good.
Here's some exciting news. I'm very excited.
Huge news over here. I adopted a kitty.
Now, walk us through how you got him. What is his name? Okay. And why? And then also, why is he not on camera right now?
Well, so, oh my God, he's right here. Oh my gosh, Riz.
I like that we might be doing a bit. Okay, you're getting him. I was like, "What? It's a podcast. If you don't see the video version on Patreon, you'll just assume we're making it up. There he is. What a good guy. What a wonderful little gentleman.
Oh my God. Okay.
In case you are not watching this video, he's a tuxedo cat.
He's a tuxedo cat with half a mustache.
He's
so
cute. I
think he loved being on camera. We'll have to change that.
Yeah, we'll get him there.
He was not on camera initially because there's construction sounds outside and he gets scared and hides under the couch when they start. His name is Riz. That was the name that the person who rescued him gave him, and I love it. I don't know what it is.
Our engineer cat asked, named after Riz Ahmed.
Honestly, similar vibes.
Good
like,
energy.
Real chill, handsome, elegant.
Hides under the couch if there's construction noise.
Yeah, yes. Knows Lena Dunham. He's just like everything I've ever wanted. I don't know. I had cats growing up. And I wanted one for such a long time. And I kind of like put it into the universe. I was like, I think I'm ready. Like, I'm not not doing a ton of shows for the next, like, couple of weeks, just, like, some stuff here and there. And then I'm home a lot, and it's gross outside. So I was like, this is, like, prime time to get a kitty adjusted.
Absolutely. Winter in New York, get a cat
in
there.
I mean, cat weather. Even though, like, today it's, like, 65 degrees, and I'm like, it's February.
Yeah, not great.
Not good. Did it snow this year? Not going to. Scary.
Wait, it hasn't snowed at all in New York?
We have not had enough accumulation to measure it, I think.
Oh,
it's like, you know,
Allison.
Flurried. And I know, it's so scary.
I mean, like, because how long have you lived in the city?
Like 16 years? 15 years?
I was there.
I've never
14.
Had a winter that it didn't snow once. I mean, I get that it's still like early February.
Absolutely.
We've got time for like a big snowstorm. March can still be snowy, but I don't know. It's like 60 degrees.
It's not great. Also, I just want to backtrack when you said that he knew Lena Dunham. I had like a negative reaction. And I think on some level, I'm just going to say this. I was like, some part of me feels like Lena Dunham eats cats like Elf or something. Like there's something about like you wouldn't want to bring a cat into her house. And that's
I wouldn't
no
want to bring
Lena Dunham. Hey, we're all on different paths. But I do think that she eats cats like Elf.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want them to ever spend time together. But my friend who has a cat and was like so supportive. She was like, you have to do it. And she was like kind of like browsing cats that were up for adoption. And a friend of hers like found Riz online and was like, wait, this cat needs a home and he looks awesome. And Julia sent it to me and I was like, wait, he seems great. And I was like on the train home from Maryland from a family funeral. And I was like on the train, like a little wine drunk. And I was like, I'm going to DM the guy and see if I could have this cat. And then like the next day I went and picked him up.
I mean, honestly, the most fruitful time you've ever slid into a man's DMs, so.
Yes. The only time I'm going to slide into a man's DMs is be like, can I have your cat? Like,
I'm so glad. He's so cute.
He's so cute, and he's really, like, aside from not, you know, loving being up on the desk, which, like, good. I don't want you on the desk. He's real chill. He likes to just, like, lean on me and just kind of lay across my lap. I don't have to, like, force him to be near me. He's always just kind of, like, circling and hanging out and He came litter trained and he knows not to get on the counters and we're just having a good time.
I'm so glad.
There will be more Riz content as we, you know, as our relationship evolves. And hopefully we'll get like a nice moment with him and his little face on this,
I'm begging you.
On this podcast.
You know, because I'm allergic to cats. So I've thought about, you know, and I've had roommates with cats that I went in my 20s, which was a horrible idea. Because it's basically like, as long as I don't touch them or interact with them, and that's not really sustainable when you live with a cat. So I'm really glad I can experience this vicariously at a distance where my allergies will not be triggered.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that like whatever, you know, cat fur thing bothers you won't come through the internet. So
thank you. I mean, you never know, but
now he's just standing amongst all of his toys that I bought him.
I want a pet.
He's so cute. I'm obsessed with him. I'm so obsessed with him.
I'm so glad.
I was like, oh, was I lonely?
I mean, I could have told you that, Allison.
I mean,
if that was the question.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm in Portland visiting a friend of mine. Her name is Megan O'Connell. She is a features editor over at Romper. If anyone reads that website, it's for parenting. Sort of, I mean, they cover a lot of different things, but a parenting website, a lot of really excellent material. She also has a great book called And Now We Have Everything about accidentally getting pregnant in her 20s and sort of like that experience. So I'm visiting her and her wonderful family. And their out-of-control dog, Wally, who is like, he's like half Grey Dane, half Rhodesian Ridgeback or something. He's a year old and he's probably going to get bigger. He's gigantic.
I mean, anything mixed with a Great Dane is already like approaching equine.
Right. And it's like, he just keeps leaping up on me. And I'm like, I really have no recourse other than like, if I were to punch this dog in the face, and I just can't do it. I just got here yesterday. I got to go at least have a couple days of goodwill before I punch their dog in the face.
You can't come in that hot.
But yeah, I another thing I've decided to do while I'm here, because Portland, I was like, there's queer people out the yang here. So I got on the, have you heard of the app Lex? L-E-X?
I have, yeah.
And so what's interesting about it, and I'm not, I have not been on any apps in years. I mean, so like even that, like just getting on
just
any
the
app.
Concept
I'm like,
of an app. You know, separate from any other, you know, personal journeys is its own thing.
Are you on the apps right now, Allison? Like, because I feel like a lot of people are on and then take a break and go back on.
I gave it a whirl a couple months ago. I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do a month. I'm going to, like, take it seriously and try and get on it, like, once a day and, like, try, like.
Which
and I
sucks.
Was just,
like, to have to mentally decide that.
I know,
like, I'm going
like, making an appointment to be like, find a person to love you. Like, on your phone.
Yeah.
And I just didn't really, like, it's never been something that I've felt good with, even though I know so many people have, like, met really great people that they've either dated or some have married. Like, I understand, like, it's not a judgment. It's just, like, it's just not, I haven't ever felt good doing it.
Yeah, it's just, like, I think it's, like, a lot of, I don't know, like, social media or, like, the things we interact with. It's sort of, like, if your mind is not set up in that way, then you interact with it in a way that I feel like it can be kind of self-punishing or, I don't know, like bring up a lot of other stuff that is not, that should not be baked into finding romance, you know?
Yes.
But Lex, I got Lex because it is dating, but it's also like, I think because it's mostly aimed at like queer women.
Yeah.
It is sort of also a community app. So like people are like, oh, does anyone like jazz? I'm going to go to this, whatever. And so I was looking at the Portland one, and I'm going to post on there, like, oh, I'm in town. Are there any, like, gay things I should go to? And then the first post is, and this is not a criticism of this person. This is people looking to fuck, and I completely support that. You know me. But the first one is, in Portland, is emergency dom shortage. And I'm like, well, I can't help with that. I don't have the skill set. And the second one is, the title of it is, looking for sociopaths. And I'm like, it just makes me feel like I have to like speed run being gay. You know what I mean? Where I'm just like, I don't have anything to add to these people's lives.
No.
Whatsoever.
Those are two really intense kickoffs.
And honestly, God, good luck to people of Portland.
Totally.
The people of Portland. I mean, if you are a dom and it seems like Portland is in need of you, maybe you could like stop by like you're like, I don't know, Wonder Woman or something, like swoop in.
Yes.
Yeah. And look, hey, we're all here for different stuff. And then also like the idea of taking photos for the app. Allison, there's nothing more horrifying to me than like, oh, I have to imagine myself being perceived.
No.
And I want to like represent it accurately, but also the idea of like, I'm going to make my friend take photos. I can't do it.
No. And I have like very few photos of myself that are not like professional or like on stage. And I'm like, well, those give away what I do. And it's not something I want to lead with like, I mean, especially like dating men, it's not something that like, I don't know if you found that back in the past, but like, there's a lot of like weird energy around like, oh, you think you're funnier than me? And it's like, yeah, I don't know.
I'll be honest, I think I didn't, but only because I pretty much exclusively dated people in the comedy community. So I was only dating other stand-ups or improvisers or people who did comedy.
Writers and things,
But maybe that was why I did, was because there, that was the one thing where, like, they already saw it. You know, like, there was no surprise. But then it's hard because I'm not telling you to date a comedian. You know, like, that's, that's tough, too.
Not anymore. So, well... We're on
journeys. We're on a journey. Also, if you live in Portland and there, you know about gay stuff that you think I should go to, tell me. I want to visit again. I love it. I've never been here before.
Oh, Portland rules.
I really like it. We went to a Hawaiian restaurant yesterday. It was great. I'm going to go to – well, we missed Queeryoke, but I did see that.
Oh,
but
that's fun.
I'm sure there's other stuff this weekend.
I'm sure there's tons of stuff. Portland's a very, like, activity-driven city.
Good. So. I'm so glad.
I think.
Yeah.
They're great food.
They're opening up like a lesbian bar in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, which is will be the only permanent freestanding lesbian bar. I'm like, that place is going to be fucking mobbed. It's called Ruby Fruit. I think it's right on Sunset. And people, I'm like, people are just going to be standing in the parking lot. And that's fine. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let us begin. Oh, God. It's still horny month. I'm so sorry.
It's honestly, it's always horny month.
It's always horny month.
We're only getting horny month on the pod.
Exactly. And I just want to say before we get into it, because I was thinking that like, so we are doing a sequel and I was like, oh, I wonder how much of the first movie Allison remembers.
It was the first thing I thought of when I was watching the trailer was I don't remember anything about this.
Exactly.
I remember some specifics, but like almost nothing about the plot.
And I want to be absolutely clear. I know that about you and I would never, ever make you remember anything. Okay.
Thank you.
But I wanted to recommend a short science fiction story that immediately came to mind. It's by Ted Chiang, who wrote the story that Arrival is based on. And this name of the short story is The Truth of Fact, The Truth of Feeling. And it's sort of like in the near future, there's this new technology called REMEM. And it's essentially like you can install search algorithms in your own memory. And, like, sort of, like, go through it. But then he sort of is talking about – and then we have someone in the past of a culture that is learning to write in written – like, written language versus doing oral storytelling. And it's just sort of, like, an interesting rumination on how memory works, where it's, like, every time we have new technology, it's true. Oh, another thing I need to bring up. My phone I listen, I'll be honest. I could have lost it, but I believe my phone was stolen. I was out in High Tops in West Hollywood having a great time, but watch your fucking phone if you're at any place with dancing in LA. And I didn't have my phone.
It's easy for it to get like just like kind of like when there's any crowded experience, it's like just put your phone in your bra.
You know, and I had it in my bag and then I took it out to text somebody and I put it in my pocket. Literally within a minute, go to reach for it, it's gone.
It's gone.
But I really had it was on Saturday, and then I didn't get my phone. Didn't get a new phone until Wednesday, and it was to go there. And thank God I had my friend write down his number and then Dave's number, and then he got me an Uber to the AT&T because I was like, oh, I don't know anyone's number by memory, and that's not good.
No. No, not one.
I think I know my mother's cell phone number, but, like, she lives in Ohio. So it's like, what would that – she'd have to do the same thing. Like, she'd have to get me numbers of people more local. Right. So that was a harrowing experience just in terms of my own memory of how – like, to suddenly have the core of your being gone and having to remember what's going on. Shocking stuff.
No, it's very hard and it's scary to not know. It's like – of all, I don't remember anything, but like I still know the number for Domino's in my hometown because we used to call it every day from the pool.
So you could always call them if something bad happens.
I'm like, is this Domino's still open? They're like, what?
Hey, Domino's, can you pick me up? I live in New York City.
I did do that once, and then we could obviously get to the pod. I never like doing a lot of rambling.
Who cares? These people don't care. They listen. They know what's going on.
You're in. In college, Natasha and I were rowers, and the boathouse that we rowed out of was like a solid couple of miles, and it was down the hill, you know, was where the lake is. And so we had like gone to practice. It was like before anybody, like most of us had cars and stuff. And so like people would pile like 8 or 9 people into a car and like drive up the hill back to where we lived. Mm-hmm. And there was one practice and it was already dark out. It was the fall. It was raining. And we were like getting ready to leave. And like everybody was like, there's no more room in any of the cars. Cause like we would run down as like exercise, like extra exercise. What a psychotic way to live. And then like would try and get rides back up. And so there was no one. And we were like, it was me, her, and another girl. And we were like, we can't. It's dark out. We just worked out for like 3 hours. Like, I can't run directly uphill for 40 minutes. Like, that's not happening. And walking would take forever. And so we were like, how do we, like, we didn't even, I think I had a cell phone, but like, I didn't know who to call. So we walked to this Papa John's that was like near the boathouse. And we were like, can we order a pizza to North Campus? And they were like, yeah, sure. And we were like, okay, cool. And can we get a ride with the guy delivering it? And he was like, they were like, no, we can't do that. That's like a huge, we do not have the insurance for that. And we were like, God damn it. Okay, fine.
It was a good idea though.
And so we like walked out and then this guy ran out who worked there and was like, I'll drive you. And we were all like, okay. And I'm like, how did we not get murdered?
I mean, you know, I despite what this podcast might show, most people are not out to murder you, you know, yes, and especially this episode, it's quite the
yes.
opposite.
Yes.
But I'm really glad you weren't murdered so that you were alive to do this pod with me. So it really worked out for me is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Well, let's begin. The sequel we're doing is, of course, Hellraiser 2, Hellbound: Hellraiser 2, which I had not seen. And it's just the fucking best.
I'm
love
surprised
it so
you hadn't
much.
Seen it. It feels like very much in your wheelhouse.
You know what I realize? I do this with TV, movies, and books. I will not watch something because then I will have watched it. So, for example, I have still not seen the last two episodes of the second season of Fleabag. Because then when I see it, I will have – I can never see them for the first time again. Yes. Which I know is – not
now,
great.
I get it.
But I realized with this too, I'm like, well, once I see it, I'll see it. And then I saw it, I'm like, well, what a delight. So I don't know what that is. Readers, write in if you could diagnose me with whatever the fuck that's going on. But yeah, I absolutely loved it. And of course, we always like to have Allison react to the trailer. Allison, what did you think of the trailer for Hellbound: Hellraiser 2?
It definitely like, I was like, oh, some of this is familiar. Like the vibe of this. I have to say, like, you know, it's like hard to know. I guess they're all going to hell. Like, that's where all the sex
they are
stuff
hellbound. Yeah.
I will say it made me miss seeing people who have not had a ton of plastic surgery.
That's a really great point. Everyone in this are like, I mean, gorgeous, but like regular people.
Right. Like, the, you know, I don't know who's who yet, but like, there's, you know, a woman that we're like tight on in a shot at one point. She has like blue eyes and like brown hair. And she's like this gorgeous 80s woman. And it's like, God, if you were making this today, and I understand that we did like, you know, but like in the hands of most directors and casting agents, like the beautiful woman who's enticing people would be like, no, big, sorry, Riz was eating the wall.
Like, oh yeah, there's, you know, a big gaping hole in the wall behind you. I mentioned
he's gone. It's a portal. Big fake lips, like, you know, all the filler, all which, like, look, all these women look beautiful, but, like, you just don't, like, it's just so refreshing to see some, like, non-altered faces.
Absolutely. And I believe you're talking about Claire Higgins, who plays Julia. And that was also a comment who returns in this film. That was something that I also noticed in the first one, and what I really loved about the original Hellraiser, and what I think was lacking in the remake, just because the remake kind of made it more about addiction rather than raw fucking lust, was that Julia is this like 48-year-old woman. She's married a man with an adult daughter. The sex is whatever, and then she has sex one time with his hot, depraved brother. And when that brother goes to Hellraiser dimension, she says,
and then he doesn't have skin.
Yeah. And then so, and this is a good recap too. And then of course, in order to get his skin back and get him back into the human realm, she helped him murder all those gentlemen she picked up at the bar.
Yeah.
And so then it's like, oh, so not only has she had sex one time and it made her insane, which is fun, but also then she has to sort of seduce all these businessmen. So it is this like, that I think what makes it hornier and more interesting is specifically because on paper she is a regular woman. Like, that is way more interesting than like, oh, the most beautiful woman in the world wants to fuck me. Sure, I'll go back and get murdered in this house.
Yeah,
exactly. I want her to have to turn it on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. A little bit of like the like under her skin under the skin.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, Scarlett Johansson, like, anybody's going to follow you anywhere.
I would be murdered by her today. And I don't even mean sexually. I just mean if she wants to straight up murder me, great. I'm totally on board.
Yeah.
But yes, I think that's a great observation. And it's like, I don't know. Like, not that you can't. We've done plenty of horror movies with, like, young, hot, like, actors and actresses.
Sure.
But there is something about the regular person being drawn into this, like, depraved escapade that I do agree makes it more fun.
Yeah.
And we always like to take a baseline scary. Allison, how scary do you find the concept of revenge? Specifically, revenge from, I guess, beyond the grave. It would be how I would think of it.
Oh, well, like, the scariest kind of revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Because that really has an axe to grind. They're dead now.
Can you imagine wanting revenge from beyond the grave? I guess it's, like, hard to imagine unless that specific situation happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Riz makes a lot of sounds, and I'm just making sure he's not dead.
Okay. I can't hear him, but I wish I could hear all the sounds.
It's not like he does meow a little bit, but it's like he, like, bumps into things. It's real cute.
I guess he's just learning your apartment.
Yeah. New space.
I love him.
He's so sweet. So I guess, like, beyond the grave revenge. Yeah, are you a grudge holder? We've talked about this. I'm not, like, the biggest grudge holder. Like, I get annoyed at people.
Right.
But, like, I'm not like, I must right this wrong, you know?
Yeah, it also just seems impossible. Like, maybe that's about, like, just giving up before I even try, which I do love to do. With Eve, like, I'm not going to do that. Like,
no.
It's like, it's a lot of work. It's in the past now. Oh, it's my God. I already have a lot of work. I'm not going to fucking seek revenge.
Not adding anything to my plate, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then before we get started, would you like to guess the twist in Hellraiser 2?
Since I have a hard time understanding what's happening in the movie anyway, I'm going to guess that maybe the woman has been dead, dead.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And all of this sex is not real.
Okay.
Like,
it was an illusion.
It's an illusion. It's imagined. Like, it's happening in somebody's mind, not in, like, actual, like, corporeal.
Ooh, okay. Oh, yeah. Like, at the end, we find out, like, someone's,
like, you haven't been fucking this whole time.
Okay,
great. But you've been imagining it.
I mean, terrifying.
I mean, it's just a sex dream.
Well, let us begin. Fortunately, there's no shortage of DOMs. There's a lot of emergencies, but there are no shortage of DOMs in Hellbound Hellraiser 2.
A lot of emergencies.
Which is directed by Tony Randall, and the screenplay is by Peter Atkins. And, of course, based on the story by Clive Barker, which was the source material for the first movie. Mm-hmm. And let us begin. We will ruin Hellbound Hellraiser 2. We open on a man's voice from the first. So this person is from the first Hellraiser. Mm-hmm. And he's asking, "What's your pleasure, sir?" And we get sort of, and luckily in the movie, don't worry, they actually have some very artful recapping of the first movie throughout the film.
Now that's what I like to see.
And it's hard to do in a sequel, especially a horror sequel. And I do feel like they do it in a, if maybe not eloquent, but a neat way, you know?
Yeah.
And we see Frank Cotton, Uncle Frank, at the end of the first movie. We see him, his face and body are being pulled apart by chains, and he licks his lips, Alice, and he says, "Jesus wept." And then we see him torn apart by the Cenobites' chains, and we get sort of the last moments of Hellraiser, which, if you remember, it's Kirsty, who is Frank's niece. Kirsty and her boyfriend, Steve, are trying to escape the house, which is physically crumbling around them as the Cenobites pursue them and taunt them. Luckily, Kirsty is able to get her hands on the puzzle box, the lament configuration, closes it, sucks them back into their dimension. And Allison, boy, you'd think that'd be the end of it. But here we go. There's a moment, a scene in the past, and we see
the past, like, being.
Oh, God, Allison.
Well, I'm just asking, like, is it from the first movie or a different time? Yeah,
what is the past? Is, first of all, I would say early 1900s.
Now we have to figure out time.
When did India overthrow the English?
Okay, so we're not talking about, like, 1989.
No. So this is decades ago, within the last century.
Okay. So just like the past, it's not like tied to the first.
No, we're seeing a little bit.
Before that.
Yeah. So I think we're supposed to think the 40s, the 30s. Sure.
Very chill times in global history.
Let's see. Okay. India remained a crown dominion until 1950. So predating that, we see a British colonialist soldier in a bunker alone. And we hear someone speaking Hindi over the shortwave radio. And we see sort of the materials of his life. We see his helmet, his rifle, and unfortunately, Allison, the most important material in his life, which is, of course, the lament configuration.
Yeah, of course.
And we see this soldier, his name is Elliot Spencer, and we see him twisting the box. Unfortunately, he's able to open it, and he is, in front of us, transformed into Pinhead. So we're seeing a little bit of Pinhead's origin story.
Oh, okay.
So, again, we're establishing Pinhead was human, which, again, was kind of a question of, like, who are these guys? How long have they been at it? Have they been at it for centuries? Are they, you know, sex aliens, you know? Did they know their origin story? And when he figures out the puzzle box, a tiny doorway opens, and you better believe a bunch of chains shoot out and attach to his skin.
Of course.
And we see the blade slicing a grid into his scalp, and then a hammer driving the pins into his skull as he screams.
I don't know why I thought maybe they came from the inside out, not the outside in.
Oh, that's so much worse. From the
inside. If he was not human, you know what I mean? Like, if he was, like, an alien where it's like, oh, that's just, like, growing the way hair grows.
Okay,
not that they were hammered
right.
in. Yeah. That they're more part of him and not foreign objects.
Because the idea of pins driving them from the inside, what would propel them? How would they get there, Allison?
I don't know.
I mean, gross either way, but wow, you took it to the next level.
I thought the pins were, like, hair.
Yeah. No, that adds up. But unfortunately, it turns out they're just pins driven into his skull by some sort of preternatural... extra-dimensional hammer, and we hear his voice whispering, "The suffering, the sweet suffering." Unfortunately, Allison, we see Kirsty wake up in the Chouinard Institute, which is, of course, a psychiatric facility.
Obviously.
And she's immediately starts getting grilled by Detective Ronson. Allison, this is the next damn day. This girl doesn't
from
even
get
from
the first movie?
From the first fucking movie. She's literally still covered in soot from the house collapsing.
I do appreciate a sequel that, really just picks right up where we left off.
Yeah, we don't need any... Like, when we see her, like, oh, she's living in America and she's healing. No, get into it. They tell her, oh, by the way, your boyfriend Steve, we sent him home. Which is, like, he's not going to be in this, so don't think you're going to see him again.
Great.
And she says, who the fuck are you? And Detective Ronson apologizes and says, you know, I was at your father's house. And they, we see Kirsty remember, oh, her father died. So her father, if you remember, one of the victims of Frank and Julia, and then Frank puts on her father's skin. So we get that moment of come to daddy, you know, Frank's sort of like incestuous lust for Kirsty in the moment literalized when he is wearing her father's skin, which of course she then realizes.
Cool.
And the movie does like a little bit of retconning because we see there's two officers, Officer Cortez and Officer Kusich, and they're in the house. And the house looks bad, but like at the end of the first Hellraiser, the whole thing's fucking coming down.
Yeah.
It shouldn't even have
it's
like
imploding.
A second floor. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So they're in there, and they keep finding, as you remember, Julia killed all of those businessmen who thought they were just going to fuck.
Yes.
And then kind of stored them in the spare bedroom, which, again, a hilarious move. So they keep finding all these corpses, and they're like, oh, actually, like, something really bad happened in this house. This is not just, like, last night there was a fire or something.
No.
And back at the Institute, Ronson chides Kirsty and says, can you tell me what happened in that house? Without a demon fairy tale. And there's so many incredible one-liners.
I could if there wasn't a demon
fairy tale
attached to this.
I don't know what to tell you. But she says, fairy tales, some of them come true, Mr. Ronson. Even the bad one. Yes!
I love it.
This is worth watching for the one-liners alone.
Dialogue, yeah.
But basically what we find out is that Detective Ronson and his crew, they assume like that she witnessed something truly horrific. Somebody in her family murdering these people. Yep. And so that she's made up the Cenobites in this story to protect herself from the truth. Mm-hmm. So that's why she's there. Like, they're going to have her sort of examined, probed, prodded, have her mind, opened up and the truth taken out, which is sort of like the overriding horror of this movie is medical and psychiatric. So there are these moments of like...
Scary.
Yeah, it's like a new level of body horror. It's the mind horror, you know?
Yes.
So Bronson gets a call from one of the officers. They say, huh, we keep finding a bunch of dead bodies. We're going to bring him in. Should we bring in this bloody mattress? And Bronson says, yeah, anything you find, it's evidence. Tag it and bag it.
Yeah. What?
But Kiersey goes, mattress. And if you don't remember, and I know you don't, Allison, it is the mattress that her stepmother, Julia, was murdered on. Mm. So Frank stabs her, and because basically Frank's like, bye, bitch. You think I was going to be like monogamous after all this? I use you to kill all those people so I could come back to the human realm. Right. And then we last time we see her, she's dying chained to a mattress bleeding out.
Okay.
So that is the mattress she died on. And Kiersey immediately recognizes, oh, wait a minute. What did I remember
know that
from?
Mattress.
Yeah. But then we meet a new villain. And it's a pretty impressive to have a new villain in a Hellraiser film. And so that's why I'm so glad is like, it's like Frasier. On paper, you'd think, okay, Frasier's like the stuffy, you know, like effete one. And then his brother would be like the man's man. No, Frasier is stuffy and effete. And then his brother Niles is even more stuffy,
yes.
Right? He's even more British in his way.
Yes.
And so similarly, it's like, oh, you don't want to have it be like, oh, no, this is real. It's like, no, he is if anything, more insane than the Cenobites. At least the Cenobites have had the actual experience.
Yes.
This guy is like a mad scientist, right?
Oh, no. I don't like that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he is the head of the Institute. His name is Dr. Philip Chouinard. And
the head of the Institute is never a good person.
Oh, no, because he has too much control. And we literally see him, again, a perfect scene to sum up, like, what's this guy's deal? He is doing open brain surgery on a patient. And the patient is alive, which I guess does happen with brain surgery. Like, The patient awake. Is awake,
yeah.
Which they do to, like, make sure, you know, that they're doing something right and they're not, like, immediately becoming unconscious.
Yes.
He's literally monologuing about, like...
The mind is a labyrinth, ladies and gentlemen, a puzzle. And while the paths of the brain are plainly visible, its ways deceptively apparent, its destinations are unknown, its secrets still secret.
You know, sort of, again, paralleling the depravity of the Hellraiser experience.
Yes.
And his assistant, Kyle McRae, looks on as he's sort of holding court. And just then, he's literally performing brain surgery, Allison. A call comes over the intercom, and he literally, like, puts down his drill and calls to Kyle and says, come on now. Leaves in the middle of brain surgery. That's how much of a piece of shit this guy is, right?
Wow.
And he sort of fills in Kyle about Kiersey's allegations, like these wild stories about the Cenobites and like Frank, her uncle coming back to life, and her stepmom murdering all these people. And they walk in to find Detective Bronson sort of in an altercation with Kiersey because she's screaming and wants to be let go, understandably. And he says, let's calm down. I want to interview Kiersey alone and have her be my patient. And Bronson says, okay, I'll come back tomorrow and we'll interview her
patient
again.
Patient-doctor is a fucked up relationship anyway.
Well, it is like similar to, in some ways, and I hope people will take this in the way that I mean it, which is simply to draw this comparison, it is like the police, where it's like you are inherently vulnerable around them.
Yes.
And you have to rely on them. And you have to rely on them to be decent people. And then that's why when you see these stories, you know, like, the one that comes to mind is like, there are these people who find out like that their sperm donor were all their fertility doctor. It turns out that motherfucker had like dozens of kids. It's like your life and your child's like existence is in his hand, and he takes advantage of you. It's such a, like, and you, why would you even think that would happen? You know, so it's that kind of thing where it's like the betrayal seems so much worse because we know as a society, like, they are more responsible. We do have to rely on them. I can't diagnose my own problems. You know, I don't have the skill
set.
No,
and the stakes are very high.
Yes.
Like, it's not just, it's like skydiving where it's like, yeah, every time it goes well, great. But the one time it goes bad, you die.
Exactly. So. Right. And it's like, we're all vulnerable. And that's, I think, again, like, that's the horror they're playing with is like the vulnerability physically, obviously, but like mentally of having someone who, as we find out, has bad intentions over you, you know. And fortunately, as soon as everyone's in the room, Kiersey says, you have to destroy the mattress because she overheard Ronson's phone call. And she's trying to explain Julia was murdered on it and she could potentially come back, much like Frank was murdered in that the room in their house, in their new house. And he came back after blood dripped on the floor. So she's saying if Frank could come back because of that, Julia could come back because of something similar.
Yes.
No one believes her. Chouinard and Bronson step out to talk, and Kyle tries to be befriend Kirstie and like calm her down. Like, don't worry. Like, this is a safe place. Like, we're here, you know, for you. And she's so upset. She's like, he doesn't believe me, does he? And Kyle says, just because he doesn't believe you doesn't mean it's not true. So that's our first sign that Kyle is going to be open to
okay.
what's going on, right?
Yes, he is in.
Yeah. So that night, Kirstie wakes up to the sound of another patient in the next room solving a wooden puzzle. And she steps out in the hallway and looks in. There's like a little window and there's a teen girl who looks up at her and she's working constantly on puzzles. Kyle approaches. He has Kirstie's night medication, so just like a sleep aid. And she says, oh, like that's Tiffany. She's been here 6 months. We don't even know her name, but the nurses have named her Tiffany. She doesn't speak and she only solves puzzles. Well, thank God, because we're going to need her here in a minute. I mean, you know what I mean?
If anyone has needed a puzzle solver, it's the people in any of the Hellraiser movies.
Yeah. But Kirstie's like, I don't want medication. She goes back to sleep. But as she's lying there, the sound of the wooden blocks grinding together and like the radiator throwing off steam, she's like, I can't sleep. And when she sits up, Allison, she sees what looks to be the figure of her dead, skinless father writing on the wall in blood, I am in hell. Help me. And she shuts her eyes and opens them again. He's gone. The message is still there in blood.
See, if it was like, yeah. If it was like, oh, everything is gone. It's like, okay, these are nightmares, night terrors.
Yeah, I'm just
like
something horrible.
The message still being there, he's in hell.
And she goes over to touch it. The blood is still wet, Allison. And then she does, this is a classic Hellraiser moment. She sort of puts her fingers to her lips and just puts the blood on her mouth.
Ew.
No real reason. It's just a fucking awesome movie.
Yeah, it's great.
In the next room, like when it happens, Tiffany looks up from her puzzle to camera. Like,
yeah,
she's obviously going to be involved. At this point, Kirstie realizes or decides on some level that she is going to have to rescue her father from the Hellraiser dimension. And Allison, I wanted to ask you, would you descend into hell to rescue your father?
I mean,
be honest with me. Okay.
75. No, I love my dad so much. He's the best.
It's also like he's not getting out of there, you know? So it's like, yeah, right. He's 75, but like your soul ostensibly is going to be there forever.
Right. Yeah. But it's like, what are the odds? Like, if the odds were very high that I could actually rescue him, mm-hmm. I would do it. But they aren't.
Yeah. Also, I don't think we have the odds. That's what I'm saying. Like, I absolutely would go to hell to rescue my father as long as he knows and I know. I'm just going to get stuck in hell and murdered. Like, I'm not going to be able to. I wouldn't know where to begin with that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think we're coming back. So it's like, it's more just like, would you voluntarily go to hell if your dad was there?
And this thing is like, I know my father and I think he would say, don't do it. But in that moment, much like Kirstie's running into, you might want to try, you know?
Yeah. I don't want him to be suffering, but I also don't know what I can do to help.
Allison, if I get sucked into hell, we've talked about this. Do not come for me.
Don't come back.
Save
for me.
Yourself.
Don't come back for me.
Please.
Don't do anything.
Live your life. Get another cat and name her Hallie, and then I will live on in that way.
Hallie cat.
Well, I want a cat. What if I got one of those hairless cats? Have you ever touched one? No.
They're very Hellraiser.
They don't
feel like what you think they're going to feel like. You have a set, like, I bet you think it's going to feel one way. That's not what it feels like.
In my mind, it feels like a snake made out of, like a scrotum. Like it's like a snake that's like has that
it's
like
not
soft
so
skin.
Far off, but it okay. is still but it's still not quite. You will be surprised when you finally
touch
one. Ooh,
okay. Well, now I want it to happen. Okay.
They're nice.
So the next day, Chouinard arrives at the Institute and does like a lap. He's sort of, you know, as king of his castle. There are a lot of patients outside. They're playing. There's like a big room with a bunch of beds in it. And everyone's doing like okay there. And then Allison, he goes to the basement level where clearly they keep the hard cases, mm-hmm. aka patients they want to lock away and forget about forever. Yes. It's horrible. There's a big boiler. It's like very Freddy Krueger, hot steam. And all these people are locked in individual padded cells. Yeah. And they're all extremely distraught
prison
and uncared
vibes.
For. Yeah. And he's just like looking in the window again, like he's looking at an insect. Kyle goes to visit Kirstie, tells him, I was visited by my father who was alone and suffering in hell. And Kyle says, okay, I'm going to go get Chouinard and maybe we can do we'll sit down and talk.
Yes.
And Kirstie says, oh, you're going to get him? Well, does he have a ticket to hell? Again, great lines.
Ticket to hell.
When Kyle goes to get Chouinard, he overhears him asking Detective Ronson to bring the bloody mattress not to evidence, but to Chouinard's personal home.
No.
This is the police are in bed with the Hellraiser dimension. What are you talking about?
That's not how it works.
Fortunately, when Chouinard does go to see Kiersey, she explains the first movie, you know, Frank and Julia. She's intuited all of it. Like, she's figured all of it. Like, Frank and Julia must have been having an affair when he was alive, but then the box got him, and, you know, somehow he came back to life, and Julia brought him men to make him stronger so she could have him. But the Cenobites came in, and she basically says, like, I made a deal, which she did, like, to lead them to Frank. Basically, like, I told them that Frank escaped, and they spared me. Only to find out that her father was killed and they gave Frank his skin, you know?
Yes.
And she says to Chouinard, do you think I'm crazy? And he tells her, I don't like to use that word. Also, Allison, he doesn't think she's crazy. Why? Because he's having the fucking mattress delivered to his house.
Oh, God.
There's so much talk about this mattress. I would love to know if there's another movie where a mattress figures in to the plot of a movie in the way this mattress does. Meanwhile, Chouinard gets the mattress delivered to his house. And you know where this is going. Kyle's, of course, like, now interested. He sneaks in. Kyle sneaks into his office. And he says, weird. Boy, you said it, Kyle.
I mean, understatement of the century.
Kyle looks in the office. Allison, there are photos of the lament configuration. There are boards with calculations. Allison, Chouinard has three lament configuration puzzle boxes under glass. He is obsessed with the lament configuration.
I mean,
and so, like, the fact that Kiersey ended up there is actually, like, an incredible gift to him.
Yes.
And we see this, we see the flashback again, like, Frank getting resurrected when blood dripped down the side of his murder. So where's Chouinard going to get blood? That's right, Allison. He's going to sacrifice the psychiatric patients in the basement.
No.
Yeah.
No. You can't do that.
And let me tell you, he'll get his, but when you find out that's what he's doing, you're like, oh, God, like, these poor
people. What a
people.
Piece of shit.
And Kyle finds a scrapbook with all these articles about sort of his theory of what the Hellraiser dimension is. And there's one called Children of the Vortex, Puberty, Puberty's Link to Psychic Phenomenon. And another headline is Death, the Fourth Dimension.
Oh, God.
As well as a photo of Elliot Spencer, a.k.a. Pinhead. So even he knows he has
Elliot
information.
Elliot Spencer as a human?
Also, is it Elliot Spencer? For a second, I was like, isn't Elliot Spencer Spitzer? The...
No. I know. It's so close to Spitzer.
Oh, thank God. I'm sorry. It is Elliot Spencer, but I was like, wait, the gentleman?
Yeah.
Was that Sidney Leathers? Was that Spitzer?
I think so. I sometimes mix up Anthony Weiner and Elliot Spitzer's stuff.
I think that actually was Anthony Weiner. Oh. Elliot Spitzer. Anywho, Elliot Spitzer is not in this. He wishes.
Okay. But a photo of Elliot Spencer as a human, not as Pinhead.
Exactly. So he's been able to trace it all the way back to Elliot Spencer. And Kyle, of course, he's like, what the fuck is this? And has just enough time to hide behind a curtain when Chouinard brings in one of his patients. This poor guy's in his straitjacket. He takes out the straitjacket and has him lie down on the mattress.
No.
He's covered in open sores, obviously horribly mistreated.
Of course.
And he begs Chouinard, like, get them off me, get them off me. And when he looks at his own skin, he's covered in maggots.
Ugh.
Chouinard pulls out
But he's not in real life. That's, like, something in his brain?
Yes. Yeah, he's perceiving it. But I think it's like, oh, his brain is interpreting his horrible open bed sores as maggots, or like maggots being in them, which is like not far off. Like, if he doesn't get treated, that's absolutely what would happen.
Yeah.
Chouinard hands him a straight razor, and the man takes it and he's trying to cut the maggots out of his skin. But in reality, as we see, he's just carving up his flesh. Well, Chouinard watches him and he's screaming, get them off me, get them off me. And he collapses to the mattress, and then he goes and he drags the straight razor across his own throat. The second he does, a skinless Julia, basically her arms shoot out of the mattress and grab the poor patient. Oy. And she wraps her legs around him. And when he sort of rolls off the mattress, she fully emerges from the mattress as she rolls with him. And then there's this incredible slow motion crawl chase scene where he's crawling across the floor. And Julia's also crawling incredibly slowly.
Is she all...
She's all goofed
no skin.
Up. It's no skin. It's just bleeding muscle.
Just wet. Real
just wet.
Wet.
So wet. And he almost makes it to the curtain where Kyle is hiding behind it. But then Julia's on him and jams her hand into his skull. And we see her bury her face in the back of his neck. I'm assuming drinking his blood or biting through his spinal cord. I didn't really understand what she was doing at that point. But fortunately, Kyle is able to escape out the window before things get worse. Allison, at this point, what would you do?
What would you do?
Oh, boy. Who am I?
Let's say you're Kyle. So you're Kyle. You've seen all this. You saw your boss essentially murder a man to bring back a skinless woman from the Hellraiser dimension.
Who comes out of a bloody mattress that should absolutely be in police evidence, but instead is here.
But also, you do get health insurance. You know, you get paid time off, you know?
I am exiting the space. And running as far away as I can at top speed. I'm stealing a car. I'm driving to another city. I am starting my life over.
Yeah. And that's what I would do too. I know, because I like Kirstie, but like, I don't know her.
No. And it's like, there's already been, you got to cut your losses.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for $1. Because saving with deals is always on the menu. With new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
Fortunately, that's he doesn't exactly do that, but he is able to escape and runs away while all this is happening. From the floor, Julia calls over to Chouinard, "Can you help me?" And he sort of slides the mattress over her and she climbs up onto it, exhausted. But then we see her like just start to writhe sexually, like on the mattress until she sits up and she fucking, you know, when you don't have skin, it's hard enough to be a woman out here. When you're a woman without skin, you got to be able to turn on the charm.
I mean, you've got to make up for it in other ways. That's a charisma game.
And she hits him with these baby blues and says, "Don't be afraid of me." Luckily, he's also totally in because he already is obsessed with the lament configuration.
Yeah, right. It's like, he's like, "You don't have to ask me twice.
Honey, I don't need skin." Yeah. The less skin, the
Who
better.
Who needs skin?
Back at the Institute, we see Tiffany assemble a new puzzle. Again, we're establishing her as our puzzle lady.
Yeah.
In the morning, we see Chouinard finds Julia looking at herself in a mirror. And she screams and punches the glass before turning to him and pouting, going, "I'm cold." And he sort of sets her up with a heater in one of his suits. And it's like a white suit with no shirt underneath. An insane choice to give her a white suit. But it looks incredible. A baggy white men's suit covered in blood with no shirt underneath. Honestly, a great look.
That's a look.
And he pours her a glass of wine and she drinks it and she takes a cigarette. And she's like experiencing human things again. Meanwhile, she's leaving blood smears everywhere in his apartment, which is very funny.
It's like on Arrested Development when Tobias is in the blue, or is like trying out the Blue Man Group, and like there's always just like blue paint on like all the surfaces.
That's a funny, like not an Easter egg, but like such a funny running gag.
Yeah.
And she turns to him and basically flashes those pearly whites, and he helps bandage her up. So basically he bandages her entire body and then gives her a dress, like for every blue, like a pretty blue-gray cocktail dress to wear over the bandages, sort of like the mummy, like going to like a work party.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
What's going on hair-wise?
There's no hair. We don't have a lick
no
of hair.
Skin.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, unfortunately. And then you better believe, Allison, they start slow dancing, okay? And again, I've said this before, there really is someone for everybody.
There is.
You know? I really believe
for every pot.
A sub for every dom, unless you live in Portland, okay?
And then there's an emergency shortage.
My God, everyone, get in your car and drive to Portland.
If you're a dom, get to Portland. I'm sure the shortage is still happening.
I mean, I'm sure whatever dom, they probably have your hands full wherever you live. I'll be honest. Right. It seems like there's
the
a lot.
The workload seems
Yeah, it's onerous. Relentless. Exactly. And while they're dancing, like, she, like, takes his hand and puts it on her ass. And he starts, like, caressing her body. And he runs his hands up her ass and, like, exposing the flesh that isn't fully wrapped. And then he puts his hand on her chest, and I wrote, I hate to say this, titty meat. Isn't it just all fat? I'm like, is it?
It is, I think. Glands and fat.
Yeah, and I was like, what is the fat? I guess if you have skin, I just had a lot of questions about, like, how the whole
thing
is.
The muscle isn't over it. It's under it.
Right. So, but I guess maybe you still have breasts. I don't, again, we're getting into the weeds here. I suppose it doesn't matter. And she turns to him and she says, now all we need is skin. Of course, we shut to poor Kirstie taking a shower at the Institute. Oh, no. Kyle comes by and thank God for Kyle. Kyle says, I saw this. It's all true. Get dressed. I'm getting you the fuck out of here.
Finally.
Pulling
this is like the smartest
you,
person we've ever seen
Truly.
In a movie. You said something.
And so he retrieves her some clothes, and he tells her, I saw this woman, and she's skinless. She's like, oh, yeah, that's my stepmom. That's fucking Julia. And she tells him, I need to get my hands on one of those lament configurations because I need to get my father out of hell. Julia does not deserve to be the one to come back. Like, fuck that bitch. The person who should come back is my father.
Right.
He says, well, he had them in her office, and I will go with you to get them.
Okay, see, now I'm back to you're dumb.
Yeah, I concur. And he tells
one step
she tells
forward,
him,
two steps back into hell, baby.
And she tells Kyle, you don't have to do this. And he says, which is very Han Solo, I know. Back at Schnard's house, he and Julia, they're fucking making out. She's got fucking just bloody lips. Like, basically her face is wrapped except for her eyes and her lips for smooching.
Just for smooching.
And then we see, unfortunately, that he has brought her another patient. And then we sort of, again, much like in the original house, there is a room exclusively for murder. And we pan across it. There must be a dozen patients all murdered. So they speed run it. Okay, I guess he was just bringing them all night. You know, because this just happened.
I mean, you gotta be efficient.
And so, fortunately, he has given her enough blood so that he unwraps her. And Julia's back, baby, and she looks better than ever. She's got hair, she's got skin, she's got it all. But she also now has power. Allison, would you rather have power or skin?
Skin.
Okay.
Skin. Every day I'm choosing skin. I'm never not going to choose skin.
But what if you had the power to buy skin?
Can she?
No.
I mean, where are you even buying skin? That's.
I guess I imagine in the Hellraiser dimension. Just look, how do you put it on? I guess it would have to be a whole suit, much like in Under the Skin. It would have to be a full suit. But anywho, she's back at it. Schnard
really
to be
like, in your size. I mean, yeah, it's just.
Right? You just have like a ponytail holder in the back, like it's a little too big. Or like one of those like chip clips in the back of your body.
Yeah, when they like, when models like, you know, for catalogs and stuff, they always like pin everything back.
Right, because they don't want to hire fat people, so they have to put them in, skin people in their clothes. Kyle and Kirstie sneak into Chenard's office, and Kirstie's like, oh shit, like he knows all about this, like this is not good.
No, it's not good.
And she runs over to one of the boxes and he says, do not open that until I check to see if they're in the house. And she's like, okay. He of course immediately finds the room with the corpses, and he's suddenly startled by Julia, who's newly skin full. But so he doesn't recognize Julia. So the way she's playing it,
right,
she's like,
he's like,
oh my God.
That can't be her. She has skin.
Exactly. But she's like, oh my God, I just stumbled on it too. Could you believe how horrible it is? And don't go in there. And he says, well, I have to. Julia. I have to see what's happening. He opens the door and he goes into the murder room. Meanwhile, back in Chenard's office, Kirstie's reading about Pinhead's origin story. We see her take the photo of Elliot Spencer, fold it, and put it in her pocket. So she's at least taking a little evidence. It's a picture of a British man, so I don't know who you're going to show that to.
Wait. It's not even like Pinhead in his final form, so.
Julia follows Kyle into the murder room and says, isn't it awful? He says, oh, my God, yes. And we see there's like one patch, like an open wound on her back. And she grabs Kyle, and I wasn't exactly sure because everything is khaki colored, but it looks like she grabbed his dick through his pants. And she says to him, come to mother. And Kyle, of course, immediately is like, uh-oh, I goofed up. And Julia says,
you done goofed up.
What's your name? I'm Julia. And of course he realizes, yes. Oh no, it's okay. Julia, that good. Lady.
Okay.
Allison, she grabs Kyle and kisses him. And we see his like life force drain from him. Like all his veins pop out. He has like boils on his face. And then she lets go and just fucking drops him like a sack of potatoes.
Oh my God.
Feature rap Kyle. On Kyle. You hate to see it. And that's the thing. Do you go back? Poor Kyle learns you can't go back.
You can't go back.
Kyle, having been gone very long, Kirstie runs into the house and finds Kyle's dead body in the murder room and says, not again. Unfortunately, Julia emerges from behind her and says, oh, hello, Kirstie. This is not a new fairy tale. It's just a different fairy tale. It says, I'm not just the evil stepmother now. I am the queen. And then they just start like fucking like brawling.
Whoa.
And of course, Julia knocks Kirstie out cold. Like yeah, she has supernatural powers.
She's super powerful. She was hanging out without skin. Like now that she's got skin on.
Yeah.
What's stopping her?
Basically, we find out Chouinard has been trying to open the puzzle box and have been unsuccessful. Mm. So he's like, you know, the one person I know who could really solve a puzzle, Tiffany, the mute teenage girl from my institute.
Yes.
And they get her and bring her out and have her solve the box. And as she's doing it, Julia says to Chouinard, are you sure? And he says to her, yes, I have to see. I have to know. Of course, she opens the box. All fucking hell breaks loose. All the glass and all the windows shatter.
Yes. They love a bursting window in these movies, I feel.
And we see Kirstie in one room or Tiffany in one room and Julia. So they're in the same room, rather, but there's two hallways that slide open. They slide open. We see this medieval stone labyrinth. So there's now a physical passage to the Hellraiser dimension. And, of course, emerging from the openings, the Cenobites. And they're all coming in. It's so dramatic. It's very much like the Catholic Mass. Like, they're, promenading in. They're, like, fabulous. They're like, hello, you know.
We are here.
And we see the female Cenobite sharpening a hooked blade to kill Tiffany. But Pinhead says, no, we're not here because of the hands that called us. We were called by desire. Meanwhile, so we see there's separate hallway. And basically, Julia and Chouinard don't see the Cenobites. They walk into the hallway. So it was like a misconnection, right?
Okay, yes.
Just as the Cenobites arrive, Julia and Chouinard walk into the labyrinth.
I
hate when it happens, you know.
Real sliding doors moment.
And this is before cell phones, so they couldn't even text each other like, hey, we're already here.
We're already here. And it's like, oh, we just left.
Unfortunately, Kirstie awakens in the murder room to see light streaming in, like this like blue light. She's like, great, the Cenobites are fucking here. She runs to Chouinard's office and grabs another box and then runs into the hallway. And she, the massive stone hallway, and she yells, Daddy, I'm coming. Meanwhile, so now everyone is entering the labyrinth, right?
Okay.
Julie and Chouinard are together. Tiffany is just wandering around lost alone in the labyrinth.
Mute.
And now Kirstie has entered to try to find her father specifically.
Okay.
Poor Tiffany wanders to a part of the labyrinth that looks like, you guessed it, an insane old carnival. So we get this like amazing.
That's not terrifying.
These amazing, it's like an eyeless clown juggling his own eyeballs. a baby sewing its own mouth shut, Allison. And we see
it. That is the most horrifying thing I could think of.
Yeah, I'll tell you, like, ooh, they were, as somebody who loves horror, clever. You gotta be on your toes and you gotta always be thinking, you know, and to see a baby sewing its lips. It was just incredible, you know. We see a sort of video repeated of Tiffany's mother, and her mother's clearly pleading Chouinard, please help my daughter. And then we see a black leather gloved hand clamp over her mouth.
No, that's not good.
Meanwhile, Kirstie finds a room that looks like her old living room and finds framed photos of her actual mother. You know, Julia being her stepmother, her mother having died, and she's looking at it like, oh my God, my mother. Unfortunately, Allison, blood starts waterfalling from under the photos and down the walls.
No.
And she screams, of course, as the Cenobites emerge from the shadows into the room. And we see the box in her hand twisted this long diamond shape, which we hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. And she said, I didn't do that. I didn't open it. And Pinhead and the female Cenobite are like teasing and laughing at her. And they're like, oh, Kirstie, so eager to play, so reluctant to admit it. And she says, absolutely not. I'm there to rescue my father. And that's it. And they said, oh, he's in his own hell. Don't worry about him. It's too late. And she says, I do not believe it. And they say, you know what? Why don't you take a look around? feel free to explore and find out for yourself. We have eternity to explore your flesh. And part of it is...
I hate that.
But we have eternity to explore your flesh?
Yeah,
you don't want someone to have an eternity to explore your flesh, Allison?
No. It's like in any other... In the movie, like, Unfaithful, I'd be like, yes, we have an eternity to explore each other's flesh. Mm-hmm. In this, I'm like, don't look at me.
Because when they say explore, you know it's not going to be good. It's not like you're
it's not like taking a tour. Like lightly caress all of your body. It's like, oh, I'm going to shave off all of your skin with a hanger. Like,
right.
It's
just, I'm going to set you on fire for 1,000 years. But part of what their sort of monologue is saying, like, we have all the time in the world. We've always been here. We will always be here.
Oh, God. That's such a horrifying, like, the permanence of it all is maybe the most chilling.
And I mean, honestly, the horror of religion, horror of Catholicism, like all of this is so Catholic, you know?
Yeah, very.
So Kiersey, they actually let her go. They're like, oh, have your fun. Go try to find your father, bitch. Like, we'll be here when you're ready to die, you know?
Yeah.
And so she sprints out back to the labyrinth. Meanwhile, Chouinard and Julia are also in the labyrinth. We keep hearing the sound of this screaming baby in the air, like over and over again. It's really terrifying. And we see at one point, much like the windows in his patients' rooms, Chouinard looks through a window and sees two men and a woman chained while also still having sex in a hot tub. And Julia whispers to him something that
like
Pinhead.
Like there'd be a rust factor, but that's
I think rust is half of the fun, Allison. Tetanus is only half the fun when you're fucking in the Hellraiser dimension. And Julia whispers to him, which is something that Pinhead said in the first movie, is come, I have such sights to show you. Fortunately, in sprinting around frantically, Kiersey stumbles on Tiffany. And she's like, oh, thank God. Okay, so you open the box, so you have to know how to get us out of here. And Tiffany doesn't reply because she's like, bitch, I don't, like, I'm a teenage girl. I don't know anything.
I don't know where the hell I am.
I solved a puzzle. What are you talking about? And we get this beautiful shot of, like, I presume a matte painting of them walking along the top of the labyrinth, which is like, it looks like an M.C. Escher, you know, like a million stairs leading to nowhere, like doors, floating things.
Oh, love that.
And then over the labyrinth, Allison, is a gigantic version of the long diamond shape that Kiersey's box had twisted into.
I think that's in the trailer. I was like, this feels new.
And it's gigantic and it's just rotating over the labyrinth. And Chouinard and Julia also see it. And Chouinard goes, oh, my God. And Julia says, no, mine. And we find out that is, of course, Leviathan, Lord of the Labyrinth.
Yes.
The god of flesh, hunger, and desire.
Yuck.
And we suddenly, in seeing Leviathan, Chouinard is, like, hit with a blast of, like, all the bad shit he's ever done to his patients and, like, what a horrible fucking piece of shit he is. Mm-hmm. And we even see Tiffany's mother begging him to help Tiffany. And he sort of cringes away from his own truth. Like, the Leviathan is showing him, like, look, you've been leading this horrible life and you've been coming to me this whole time. And Julia says, this is what you wanted. He says, no, help me. And Julia turns to him and says, why do you think I was allowed to come back? It wanted more souls.
No.
And she shoves Chouinard backward into sort of like a dark, like, closet, like a cabinet, which has, like, emerged from the stone behind him.
Good. Great.
And it's sort of like a Cronenberg-style parody of medical experiments. So, like, this, like, thick, like, biological tentacle emerges that injects him with, like, blue and red fluids. And it's sort of like, again, like, the playing with the body and, like, the medical instruments. These two monstrous hands lower what looks like – have you ever seen, like, a wire slicer, like, at a deli? Like, they use to slice, like, cheese?
Yes.
So they take one of those and they start drawing it across his face – slicing into his throat and his face.
No.
And one of the monstrous hands just drives, like, it's either a fang or, like, a curved, like, claw into his screaming mouth. And Julia says, goodbye, doctor, as he is dragged away into the void. Allison, like, I gotta ask you, who will survive?
Who will survive?
Now, I cut you off there, so I
do have a question before I attempt to answer this. Isn't that what he wanted?
This is fundamentally the issue with Hellraiser, and that was the issue with the first movie as well.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, Frank opened it in the first one, and he's like, I got to get out of here. I'm like, but, like, isn't that – I think we're to think, and what we'll find out in this movie is, like, you really have to have the right temperament.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're the kind of person – like, I think the reason that Julia is able to, like – maneuver this and actually seems to be getting off on it and, like, is able to, like, serve Leviathan. She's that kind of person. And I think we're going to think other people, if you're not cut out for it, you might not – you just can't survive it. But that's the conundrum of, like, mm-hmm. wouldn't – experiencing pleasure that's also painful beyond measure, wouldn't eventually you get used to it or, like, mm-hmm. at least start to enjoy, have some fun with it?
Yeah, okay. I guess, like – and I do think that this is, like, true of, like, actual, like, real world, non-Hellraiser world. Like, when some people are like, oh, I think I might like this. And then it's like, I'm not cut out for this, like, sexually or even just like other physical experiences. You're like, whoop, maybe not. So I could see maybe he's like, yeah, I'm into this. And then all of a sudden it's happening. He's like, actually not me.
And we'll find out sort of what happens in a minute here. I think that's a great question.
I am going to – it's, like, hard because I'm like – who's technically alive?
So technically alive, we've got Kirstie and Tiffany.
Okay. I think that Kirstie will die. She'll end up trapped in hell with her father.
Okay.
And they'll be together, but in hell and dead. Yeah. And that Tiffany will survive and escape and I don't know. Aren't there more of these movies? Or
There sure are. There are
so
sure
I feel like she seems like a prime person to, you know, carry on into the next film. So yeah. I'm going to guess Tiffany survives. Final girl.
Great. And then other than that...
I mean, everybody else is kind of, like, dead and in this other dimension. And it's like, I guess you stay there for eternity. So, like, not much is changing there.
Right. How do you live once you're already dead?
Right.
Always
a question. All right.
One we simply are not going to answer.
We'll take it.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
So Kirstie and Tiffany continue into the labyrinth until looking for Kirstie's father, until Kirstie sees, like, the stained glass door that was the front door of her father's house, one that where all the events crumbled. Of the first movie happened. So Tiffany immediately, like, tries to drag her away, but Kirstie says, no, I have to rescue him. And she tells Tiffany, if I'm not back soon, escape and close the box. Get out of here and save yourself. So again, saying the right thing, like, just get the fuck out of here if you need to. When she walks inside, it's like a long chapel-like space with dozens and dozens of candles. And we see a platform roll out of the wall. And it's a white transparent sheet over a writhing woman, like a beautiful woman, like screaming and moaning in ecstasy, covered in a white sheet. And then it rolls back in. And then it rolls back out, this time with two platforms with two women. Mm-hmm. And then, Allison, you're not going to believe this. It happens a third time. Now there's three women
nude
under their sheets on these platforms.
True in comedy, true in horror.
And Kirstie says, which, again, she's a plucky gal, fuck this, and then pulls one of the sheets away, only for the woman underneath to disappear. She walks on.
Great.
She finds, like, a vanity with, like, spilled makeup on it and a candle. And she looks at a lipstick. I thought she was going to put it on because it's like, listen, you might as well – if you're the labyrinth, might as well turn to look.
I mean, yeah. That's exactly the place to try something new.
When she looks up, written in lipstick on the glass is the same message. I am in hell. Help me. Allison, she turns and the three nude women roll out from the wall. They're now covered in blood. They're soaked in blood.
But they have skin.
They have skin. As far as we can tell, under the sheet, there is skin there.
Okay.
They definitely have boobs, and I think that requires no skin.
Yeah.
A figure emerges from the shadows, but Allison, it's not her father. It's her Uncle Frank. And he, of course, immediately grabs her and is, like, on his bullshit. He says,
don't be naughty, Kirstie, or I'll have to punish you first. Huh? Perhaps you'd like that.
Ew.
And she's like, you're my uncle. And
get the fuck away from me.
And he gestures to the nude women under the sheets and says, "This is my hell. Every day they tease me forever, but they never deliver." So his hell is being having beautiful women that he can't fuck. I was like, this could actually be a lot worse, dude. Like, grow
this
up.
This is like many men's experience on earth. Like, it's
this is my experience. Like, I'm polite yes, about it. Like, just because there are women there doesn't mean you have to have sex with them, Frank.
Right, and that you are entitled to get to fuck them. And like, also, like, no one is like wire slicing your face off. Like, I don't understand. Like, what the
not
like,
yet? Anyways,
just to have the like
exactly
the like pain of like unfulfilled desires is not the same as like skin ripping.
Right, a tentacle being rammed on your throat and poison being injected into your veins.
Yeah, that's very different.
Yeah. And he tells her, you know, that wasn't your father who delivered the message. That was me, Kirstie. And I did it so you'd come down here to be with me.
What a dickhead.
And just then that a platform with no nude woman on it, a clean sheet-covered platform rolls out of the wall. And the implication is, I'm going to fuck you on this platform. Peace. And she tells him, okay, I'll do anything. I just don't hurt me. But then she walks to the platform. She snatches up the sheet, which is instantly you recognize it's polyester. And she holds it up and she says to Frank, I'd rather burn. And she hurls the sheet at the vanity, which is covered in
candles.
I'm going to say 1,000 tea lights.
Sure.
And the whole thing bursts into flame and immediately sets off, like, the whole room is suddenly in flame. Now, something happens. I don't entirely know what's happening, which is he starts to claw off his own skin and is screaming, no, no, not my skin. And it's like, bitch, you're doing that. But, again, I don't run the Hellraiser dimension. And suddenly the flames die down, and we now see that Frank is totally skinless. And they both turn and look, and Kirstie, right behind Kirstie is Julia, who has captured Tiffany. So Tiffany and Julia, now we're all in the same room. And Frank says to Julia, I knew you'd come. I knew how much I mean to you. Kiss me, and we'll have a real family reunion.
No.
And Julia goes over to Frank, again, skinless, and like sensuously rubs her fingers over his lips before plunging her hand into his back and ripping out his heart. And he falls to the ground, and she tells him, nothing personal, babe.
But, like, now what happens to him?
I imagine he just materializes back together and then, like, has to stay there, right? Because he's not alive.
Right, you're not alive. But he wasn't before. Like, it's like, I just don't, like, some of the rules of the Hellraiser dimension are confusing to me.
Absolutely. I guess what I think, he's not dead. Or like this kind of death is not the standard death that we're familiar with, if that makes sense.
Like this will continue, like it'll be more like Sisyphean.
Yeah.
Like where it's like this keeps happening. Forever. You were punished forever. Like she can come back and rip your heart out anytime. You're going to regenerate and you have to keep living in this hell of like not fucking these women.
Allison, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you hit the pin into the head.
I hit the pin right into the head instead of out from my skull.
That's really, that's going to keep me up at night.
I can't believe I said something that upset you.
I honestly forgot about it. I'm thinking about it again. It's even more upsetting. Like a chia pet or something, you know?
As someone who has metal implanted in their body in a very serious and terrible way, I don't find it that scary to imagine compared to all the other things that we've talked about on this podcast.
If somebody had a giant super magnet, would you get stuck to it, do you think?
No, because it's titanium, which is non-magnetic.
Oh, cool. Like the Sia song.
Yes.
Okay, great. So fortunately, in this sort of chaos, Tiffany and Kirstie take the opportunity to run, but Kirstie still has like the diamond-shaped puzzle box. She drops it and Julia manages to pick it up. So now it's in Julia's hand.
Oh, boy.
And we see, unfortunately, we were talking about earlier, like whether or not you're cut out for the Hellraiser dimension. Turns out, Chouinard was, because we see at the top of the labyrinth, this dark cabinet emerge, and he emerges now a Cenobite, totally hairless.
Yeah,
bound
well, that's
by
like
wire.
Where he belongs.
And he says to himself in that like pinhead, like gravelly voice. He's also wearing like S&M gear, obviously. He says to himself,
and to think, I hesitated.
So now he's just having fun.
He's like, we are here. Let's do this.
Allison, from the side of the labyrinth, a huge slimy tentacle with a lamprey eel mouth latches onto the...
You know, this is like the second time in horny months we've talked about lamprey eels. And it's like, what is up with these guys?
I want to say it's because it's vaginal. I want to say there's something about it that evokes... It's like, it is the
it is both
vagina
vaginal
dentata.
And phallic.
Yes. The perfect combination of the two.
Wow.
The lamprey
wow.
eel. Unfortunately, the eel latches onto the top of his head and sort of like now is puppeting Chouinard.
Chouinard, okay.
And his reaction, and like I don't fault the actor, but his reaction is like no 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 like it's so it's not like what you think it's going to be. It looks like he's like like in Home Alone 2, you know, when when the bandits gets electrocuted, he turns into a skeleton. Like it's a little silly for this point of the movie, but it's really fun. Meanwhile, Julia is trying to catch up to Tiffany and Kirsty to kill them, keep them in the Hellraiser dimension. And this horrible wind starts blowing through the labyrinth. They're all being blown around. But Tiffany sees the puzzle box in Julia's hand now. And she grabs Julia's hand. And just as she does, Julia's skin, much like in under the skin, actually, Julia's skin rips off like a sort of a glove coming off a hand.
Ugh.
And her actual body gets sucked down the labyrinth into a void carried by some sort of unholy wind.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So her hand is still clenching it, but her hand is just skin, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Tiffany, I think, and Kirsty realize, we got to get the fuck out of here, okay? People are getting ripped out of their skin. We don't know why. We got to get out of here.
Yeah.
So they run for it, and they make it back to the hospital out of the labyrinth, but the door to the labyrinth is still open. And Kirstie's caught up because she's like, I couldn't find my father. I failed him. And she's like, Daddy, I'm sorry. Tiffany, meanwhile, as the mute teenager, is like, we got to get out of here. And they start running and they run through that big open room of patients. Allison, all of them are playing with a different puzzle box.
Jesus Christ.
And at the end of the room, they have like these big double doors. They burst open. And Chouinard, who again is now in
whole,
leather.
Got a whole thing going on.
Dangling from the tentacle, which puppets him, bursts in and says, the doctor is in.
Incredible writing.
And Tiffany says the first word. So again, Tiffany has not said one word. She says the first word she says all movie, shit. Again, it's perfect. It's a perfect film.
Brilliant.
And if that wasn't, if the one tentacle wasn't bad enough, Allison, Chouinard lifts his hands and three tentacles explode from each hand. So he has these like, they're like, again, very phallic, like snake mouth, but like the ends of the tentacles can become different things. Like it becomes a knife blade. It becomes like another little mouth. It becomes a barb. And he latches onto the closest patient and he screams, ah, so you're a doctor, I recommend amputation. Allison, he kills all of the psychiatric patients in that room.
Yeah, no shit.
Kirsty and Tiffany duck into another room to hide. Wouldn't you know it, the Cenobites are already there. It's full of those chains hanging from the ceiling.
They come prepared.
And they're like, all right, Kirsty, you had your fun. We let you look at the labyrinth, but no more deals. So don't think you're getting out of it this time. Okay. And she says, well, I don't have a deal. I'm not here to trick you. I just have information. And from her pocket, she takes the photo of Elliot Spencer, Pinhead, that she stole from Chouinard's office. Mm-hmm. And she handed it to Pinhead. He's like, who is this, some other escaped soul, like your Uncle Frank? Like, we're supposed to give a fuck about this person? And she tells him, no, it's you.
You
were all human once. And the Cenobites really take a minute and reflect on that. They're like, oh, that's crazy. And like, Butterball's there and the Chatterer and they all kind of like, oh, wow. It's
all the major players.
Wow. It really makes you wonder what we're up to. We used to be like them. And in that moment, Chouinard again bursts in a room and says, I'm taking over this operation and you girls will be my first. I'm taking over this facility and you girls will be my first operation. So I think the problem with that is Chouinard is actually trying to one up the Cenobites and that pisses them off. Pinhead says to them, oh, good, a fight. And then he starts shooting chains into Chouinard's body. So it's a brawl. It's Chouinard versus the Cenobites.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Chouinard's like incredibly powerful. And so he's able to like pierce.
Really took to the Hellraiser dimension.
Oh, like, yeah, gangbusters.
Like a fish to water.
Again, he was built for it. And he starts like incapacitating all the Cenobites. And as Tiffany watches in horror, we see the Chatterer get skewered against like, I think we mentioned for the first movie, like there's sort of a spinning pole that has like human flayed flesh on it and ears. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Chandler gets skewered against the pole, only for the pole to turn and reveals a small human boy. And I think, and still in the Chatterer's costume. So I think we're supposed to be like, they were really children. Like, they were people. And, like, he has now been returned to his human form in the saddest way, which is like, oh, he was a child, you know, at some point. So I think it's just sort of, like, revealing their humanity in this way that we're supposed to kind of sympathize with the Cenobites. And at this point, everyone has been incapacitated or otherwise taken out except for Pinhead. And Shenard shoots his blue lightning out, and Pinhead is transformed back into Elliot Spencer. And Shenard slits his throat. And we see him choking and gagging and collapsing. So as far as we know right now, Shenard has murdered all of the Cenobites. Wow. Tiffany and Kirstie run into the hallway. If I'm them, I'm like, well, I'm not getting out of this alive if they killed those guys. Yeah. What does that even mean?
Right. If he could kill them and they were going to kill us.
Yeah.
It's a no-win.
Tiffany tells Kirstie, I have to go back and solve the puzzle to end this. Basically, she has to go in and solve the diamond-shaped Leviathan puzzle. She's like, it's not enough to solve a regular puzzle. I have to solve that one to close the labyrinth. And I was like, Tiffany's very good at puzzles because I would not have figured out why you'd do that. Yeah. So they run back into the labyrinth and they make it back to Julia's like deflated skin, which holds the Leviathan box. And Tiffany runs up to the god itself, the Leviathan level, and she leaves Kirstie behind. This is Tiffany's path now. And we see Tiffany again flashing back, and we see the truth of what really happened, which is Shenard murdered Tiffany's mother and experimented on her, and is just sort of keeping her there specifically, ostensibly, to open the puzzle box. Ugh. So now this is Tiffany standing up being like, fuck you, motherfucker.
Kill him.
Exactly. And Kirstie runs up behind her and says, I see it now. It's a puzzle, referring to the Leviathan. Like, it's a god, but it is also a puzzle.
Yeah.
And you can solve it, right? Like, we've solved the other puzzles.
You solved everything else. Yeah.
Unfortunately, Tiffany's about to open the diamond-shaped puzzle. Shenard, on his stalk, emerges from the side up next to her. And the puzzle box flies out of Tiffany's hand. And I'm going to say it, Allison, it sure seems like all hope is lost.
Does seem that way.
And Shenard sort of looms towards Tiffany, tells her, surgery's open. And what's this? What's on today's schedule? Evisceration.
Wow.
Suddenly, from behind, Tiffany is grabbed by Julia. And Shenard says to Julia, I knew you'd come back. And they go and they embrace each other and they kiss, which gives Tiffany time to solve the puzzle. We're talking 5 seconds. Like, this is, like, insane. And I wrote my note, this bitch loves puzzles. Unfortunately, Shenard, he was distracted by this hot kiss, and he grabs for Tiffany and he shoots out his tentacles, which now have blades at the end.
Oh,
and she's
good.
Able to dodge out of the way, and the blades get stuck into the concrete of the labyrinth.
Yeah, what kind of structures are we dealing with here? But yeah.
And so he's trying to like pull. He's stuck to the labyrinth. Mm-hmm. So when his proboscis tries to lift him up, he is stuck. He's being strained between his tentacles and the stalk to the point that his head gets fucking ripped off his body.
Great.
Tiffany tumbles to the edge of the platform and Julia reaches down for her. And of course, she doesn't want to take Julia's hand.
No, don't trust this bitch.
But Julia says, trust me. And when she takes her hand, she hauls her up. And when she finally is safe, Julia reaches up and pulls off her skin. It was Kirstie underneath there. She put on Julia's skin so that the Leviathan wouldn't recognize her.
Wow. So, way to go, Kirstie.
I know. So everything is good. Unfortunately, Kirstie screams, we got to get out of here. And the Leviathans, of course, is like twisting and like shooting blue lightning throughout the labyrinth. Like the Leviathan itself is being undone. So they sprint back to the hallway and they make it through the door right to the Shenard Institute, to the sound of a baby screaming and crying. And they make it into the room just as the door closes behind them. And they laugh and they smile. Now, of course, all of the other beds in the facility have, like, floral wreaths on them because all of the patients were murdered, which seems rude. I was hoping at the end that it would be like, oh, it turns out they weren't dead or something, but they were.
No.
Allison. Oh, so we see Tiffany and Kirstie leave the facility ostensibly to build a life, you know, free of the Cenobites. Unfortunately, when Chenard's home is sold and the movers are packing up, they find the blood-soaked mattress in his office. And it's still wet to the touch.
Yeah, of course.
And one of them touches it.
I assume that it's wet all the time.
All the time. it's hard to dry a mattress. Yeah. And one of them touches the mattress and calls down to his coworker, says, get a look at this. And an arm shoots out and grabs him. And when we see the coworker come in to check, he is horrified to see a rotating column emerge out of the mattress. And as it rotates, we see it's covered in flayed skin, screaming human faces, including Chenard and Julia. And finally, we turn and see the man we saw at the beginning, who is the man who retrieved the box out of the fire at the end of the first movie. And he's got, you better believe it, Allison, grasshoppers crawling all over his face. And he asks, what's your pleasure, sir? The Hellraiser.
Wow.
So, Allison, tell me, what are some fatal mistakes you think people have made in the movie Hellbound, Hellraiser 2?
Fatal mistakes.
I mean, Chenard's whole deal.
Yeah.
Is a fatal mistake. Like, wanting to go into the hell, being obsessed with the Hellraiser realm, murdering so many people in order to get there. It just is not.
Yeah.
Not a good way to be.
But then I think to your point. Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, like, to your point, it's unclear because it's like he did eventually be like, oh, I can't believe I hesitated. But then his head got ripped off. But to your point, it's like, well, does that mean it'll just grow back? Or
right.
Like, he's not. If he's already dead in a conventional sense and he can't die in the Hellraiser sense, then maybe it wasn't a mistake and he was right. But also, boy, he seemed pissed when his head got ripped off.
Right. Like, that doesn't seem like he was, like, his end goal.
Yeah.
And then I think also, like, Kyle, you were so right in going back and being like, I saw this. We got to go. And then when Kirsty was like, her being like, I'm going into Hellraiser to save my father from hell.
Yeah.
He should not, like, he should have been like, no. We are running away forever. We are not doing this. And then they both would still be alive.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I guess what's hard about it is, like, you just don't want to see your dad burning forever in hell. You know what I mean? And if you could get him, knowing that she knew what she knew, which was that Frank returned, it just seems like everyone who does return is evil. Yeah. So her father wouldn't be able to return because he wasn't evil. He was just a regular person.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Kirstie.
But everyone else feels like they're really, you know, trapped in this grand design. So,
yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Not like, a ton of free will.
Yeah. Like, what is their. Right. They can't leave. I mean, it doesn't
they're
seem.
They're there. That's what's happening.
And also, yes, there are a lot of other movies in the franchise. So we'll find out even more about Elliot Spencer and, you know, sort of his adventures in space. And then finally, where would you put Hellbound Hellraiser 2 on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
I think, like, because, like, the actual, like, the plot and, like, the world I know are so, like, beyond our reality and, like, not something where I'm like, is this going to happen to me? but the horrors happening are so disgusting.
Yeah, grotesque.
Like, no skin, lots of, like, devices that shouldn't be weapons becoming weapons and all the kind of, like, I think a 7.
Okay, great. Ooh, okay. Okay, great.
Hi, I know, but scary.
You know, I'm sorry. I feel like we got a comment recently, like, I always, like, rate them lower than people think. But I'll be honest, like, the things I found really scary about this is, like, the brutality that is realistic. And then once you get, you know, a man on a giant tentacle busting into a mental institution, screaming,
the doctor's now having fun.
That's just a blast and a half. Yeah. I'm having a great time versus genuinely being scared. I'm going to give this a 4. You know, again, 10 for how much I fucking enjoyed this.
Right, yeah. 10
out
of 10.
But not scary, you know, but not scary conventionally.
10 tentacles out of 10 tentacles for fun.
The worst moment is when Chenard is watching his patient.
That's fucked up.
Cut himself with a razor.
That's awful.
And actually, I'd like to make a book recommendation. And see, this is why I think I was supposed to, not supposed to, I don't believe in that, but like, everything has a silver lining. My silver lining of losing my phone is I was forced to read books.
Oh.
Well, on the toilet mostly, but like, I was just like, I needed to be having something in my hand. And so I started reading a book that I'd purchased and really had wanted to read, but didn't. It's called Stranger to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us by Rachel Aviv. And it's really good and touches on some of the themes, actually, that are discussed in this movie. Specifically, like, what are the narratives that we give people with mental illnesses to understand what's going on? Mm-hmm. And if they're wrong, or alternately, if there's no way to really know if they're right or not, how does it affect how they think of themselves and, like, their experience of their illness? And the first chapter is this really interesting story of this guy who was in a facility for about a year that did not believe in medicating depression. And it really was sort of like of a time where mental illness was like a personal defect rather than a medical problem. He gets out. He goes to a different facility. He's there for 3 months. They give him medication. He ends up suing the first facility. So it's sort of seen as this like seminal moment in establishing that you could treat mental illness with medication. Mm-hmm. But it does sort of like, it doesn't really, you know, it's not like it's like his life turned out great. It's just like, it didn't really resolve everything, but it sort of like each chapter explores different situations and different people who are caught between like, there's no easy answers, you know? So it's like the answers you as a doctor try to provide your patient might influence how they conceive of themselves in a really negative way. Yeah. So if that sounds interesting at all to anybody, check it out. Strange to Ourselves. And again, I think I had to have my phone stolen to return to my love of reading. And, you know, what could you do? And hopefully they didn't steal my identity. You never know. Exactly. All right. And, well, on that note.
Read some books. Stay out of the Hellraiser dimension. And most importantly.
Keep it horny.
Keep it Riz.
Keep it Riz. Baby Riz.
Ruined is a Radio Point production with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder. Recorded and edited by Kat Iosa.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.